So Pon has been studying at LSE for some time and also has held teaching positions at LSE, at UCL, and at my own alma mater, SOAS. But she has now moved out of London to one of the great cities of the world, the city of Manchester, where I was born. And she's teaching, or working at the University of Manchester in as a research associate in the Global Development Institute, and they have something called the Future Dams Research, dams in capital letters. So she's actually working specifically on things to do with dams, but more broadly the design assessment of water, energy, food, and environment mega systems, which is quite a mouthful. But today you are specifically also talking about dams. So we're going to hear something about crossing over. Dams obviously are on rivers, and rivers go between countries, so we're talking about things that straddle different countries, I assume, in the greater Mekong region, but I don't know exactly what's coming, so rather than give some garbled summary of what may or may not be coming. Bob, please.
I'll be talking about dams you can see and then a lot of invisible things you can't. So the talk I'll be giving today is work I started during my doctoral work in Laos on a Fulbright-funded grant, but that I've extended further. I currently work on Ghana, Myanmar, and Uganda, so it'll be some insights mostly from the Mekong region, given that I'm giving a talk today at the New York Southeast Asia Network. I'll first be talking about the changes in the international finance system, how that's driving dam development, how that's played out in Laos. So, to start off with, when people think about dams, they think about what Nehru called the temples of modernity. And so in the post-war period, dams for post-colonial leaders like Nehru and Nasser here, dams were for them this idea that they would be foundational projects that would jumpstart industrialization, that would provide the energy for aluminum processing, agricultural industries. The taming of the Nile, for example, in the Aswan Dam in Egypt, was all about gaining control over flooding of the Nile so that Egypt could harness that for agricultural production. And so what I want to draw and what I'm getting towards in terms of today's main argument is that the post-World War II dam building exercise in terms of dams as temples of modernity has shifted to what I'll say, this is just to backtrack a second. So these temples of modernity, for example, in Egypt and India, here we see parts of the Nile that have basically become green and produced bread for several generations of people in Egypt. Here, you know, dams over time have provided electricity for growing in cities across India, what was called the Green Revolution. All of this was somewhat provided by national scale planning and modernization drives in terms of infrastructure development in the post-colonial world. But we have to really think about the fact that post-colonial leaders, when they were building dams, came out of a colonial context in which they were quite mistrustful of the international system and how they gained access to money, of the kinds of financing sources that they took on. And I'm going to make the argument that today, dams are proliferating at a very quick pace. Dams that might have taken decades to get financing, to get approval, are now, you know, my colleagues study singular dams in Ethiopia or Tanzania. In Laos, each year, the government is signing off on 10, 20 dams at a time, which is mind-bending. So here in the 1990s, Laos was involved in somewhat, it took them about, you know, most of the 1990s to get to 4 projects. By this year, they've gotten up to about 40 projects. They have a number of projects continuing under construction, and by next year, they hope to complete 100 projects. This is a photo that I took from a plane in 2016, just before Obama's historic visit to the country of Laos. The River Um in Laos, which runs north and south from China down to the Mekong. I took this photo from a plane just before the historic ASEAN summit in which former President Barack Obama paid the first presidential visit of any kind to Laos, which had been, you know, more bombs were dropped in Laos in the 20th century than all modern wars combined. So the River Um in 2016, as you can see, this is the last time anybody's ever going to see it without dams, because what has happened since is that Power China has been able to gain a concession to develop 7 dams across the Nambu River. And so what I want to make an argument for today, the main argument, is that these temples of modernity that were supposed to serve as foundations for national economic development are now portals for international global financialization. So this is a picture of one of the first 7 dams across in the Nambu, started by Power China. It's the second one. This is just some examples of basically one of the 7 dams across the Nambu. But I'm not just talking about the Nambu. This is just kind of where I start. This is a general map of some of the projects that were aimed to be developed in Laos. This is another sort of visual to give you an idea of all these black dots in which dam development is taking place in Laos. So it tells you something about how money seems to be flowing into such a small country, which sits on a third of the Mekong. Laos is landlocked. It's only got 6 million people, 6.5. The one-party state is rapidly aiming to graduate from least developed country status into middle-income status. So that's a pretty strong ideological motivation. What I want to get to in terms of my talk is to talk about how financialization of dams, and what I'll get into the details of what I mean by financialization of dams, but the introduction of capital markets into the financing of dams is also changing the time frame and the incentive structures in terms of getting to a financial close on these projects and what that means for shortcuts, cost cutting, and dam safety in the world. This is a dam collapse that happened last year in July. It washed away 35,000 people in neighboring Cambodia. At least 50 people died. We don't really know because there was restricted access to the dam area when the dam broke. But this dam was $1.3 billion. It reached financial close in 2013. It started construction in 2014. So the dam that broke was, the saddle dam that broke was part of a project that was less than 5 years old by the time it broke. And it had been heralded at the time that it reached closing agreement as, you know, this at the forefront of the financing frontier, what dam financing could be in Myanmar, neighboring Cambodia. And so I want to make an argument about the implications of fast finance and dam safety and thinking about that. All right. So the roadmap will basically be, I'll be giving a little bit of a talk about the financing landscape in the world, some more details about financialization, and then for those of you who might not be initiated into Southeast Asia, Laos sits on a third of the Mekong River, which flows across 6 countries from China through Myanmar, Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Thailand. And I'll make 3 main arguments, as I've been saying, that rather than temples of modernity, dams are have shifted from public goods that were built by and owned by and built for the public to infrastructures that are primarily driven by short-term portfolio investments from foreign financiers. Some of the pitfalls in the different kinds of finance and the different financial groups that are driving this phenomenon. Money is not stateless, and I want to make the clear point in today's talk that the states behind different kinds of money, different kinds of contracts, make a difference to the kind of dam development we see, and then some of the unintended consequences we might not think about. So firstly, I named the first part between a rock and a hard place, because if you think about dam development from the view of a developing country bureaucrat, there's this false illusion that there's more money than ever before, that money is not a constraint. We have international capital markets, we have a number of state development banks, we have, you know, the traditional multilateral development banks in the world, so there are more actors than ever before offering money. So there's an illusion that developing countries are not capital constrained, they're not constrained by money. However, I want to make an argument in this first part that even though there's an illusion of capital availability, that money comes with a lot of constraints, and some of perhaps more constraints than ever before, and that's something to be aware of. So to give an example of how this seems to be evolving, the World Bank had taken a 10-year moratorium for financing any dams in the world. And when it returned to dam financing,
it started its campaign in Laos with a very famous project called the Nam Chen Tu Project. And it took them 10 years to develop in terms of studies, consultations, getting the financing package together. That experience in and of itself, a number of things happened from that experience, and which I'll talk about in a second. But since then, the World Bank has disappeared as a main financing actor in the Lao context. The next projects that I'll talk about later mostly have been driven by Thai commercial banks, a combination of Thai commercial banks and some Korean construction firms. And more recently, we've had a shift away from regional. So there's still some regional financing arrangements, but more bilateral deals with China. And I don't think that this is particular to Laos. Here in Uganda, it's outside Southeast Asia, but just to give more context to the financing landscape in the hydroenergy sector across the world, you see the same pattern in which the World Bank took a number of years, 12 years, to try to build Budagali with the help of Blackstone private equity group, Wall Street-based private equity group in Uganda. The project yielded more energy than the country ever needed, but only 18% of the people could access it because it was too unaffordable. So given that private sector-driven, Wall Street-driven projects facilitated by the World Bank, they come with very high tariffs, the Ugandan government has now switched to bilateral financing with China. So again, this pattern continues in terms of Ghana for different reasons. The Ghanaian government tried to build the Bui Dam, and after an environmental impact study found that 20% of the Bui National Forest would be submerged underwater, and that a very rare hippo species would be endangered, the financing groups pulled out because of reputational risk and environmental risk. And so China again came in as an unsolicited bid and took on the project in terms of financing in Ghana. So I'm making the point that there's a wider transition and shift going on in terms of the financing landscape and patterns across countries that we should be aware of. And so in the post-World War II context, when I was talking about Nehru and Nasser, projects were state-owned, they were state-developed, the money came from the World Bank, they came on generous terms, long-term financing, concessional financing, so north-south finance, and they would be, or you know, through Cold War aid, and they would be given directly to governments, or sometimes even directly to the different energy utilities that were running these projects. That doesn't exist today. Financing after the Cold War is financed particularly through what I'll call state capitalism, but it's private sector led. What I really mean is Chinese firms that are supported by Chinese policy banks. So state-assisted financing for private sector firms. So they're not state-owned firms, they're state-controlled firms. So Chinese party leaders or government officials or government entities might own anywhere from 20 to 45% of the company. So they're state-controlled enterprises, but also private sector-led in terms of, you know, pension funds in the UK, in the US through private equity firms or institutional investors, asset managers. So the G20, anywhere from the G20 to the new, you know, sort of Trump speak about the US International Development Bank, anywhere you go in the world, from Europe to the US to Asia, whether it takes, you know, Brazilian Development Bank guys or Chinese policy bank guys or any European Development Agency speak, they're still all talking the same speak in terms of using agencies to facilitate private sector investment to fill the infrastructure gap, that somehow the private sector is going to pay for all this infrastructure, which is historically really different to long-term loans directly to states and the public owning these assets. These are now private sector actors owning infrastructure assets in developing countries. They do so through legal entities called special purpose vehicles. These special purpose vehicles, just to simplify them, for example, they're very complex, legally and financially engineered entities that are codified into these contracts. But basically, they create structures that allow foreign actors, domestic actors, to combine risk and financing to make projects happen. And so a lot of this has enabled South-South finance. And what I mean by South-South finance, again, is emerging country firms that now invest in other developing countries. So Southern commercial and policy banks, like Chinese policy banks, the Exim Bank, for example, Thai commercial banks, Korean commercial banks, Brazilian development banks, these are all private sector actors from the developing world investing in other developing countries. And they do so through projects. So the money goes directly to a project, which means if the dam collapses, like it did in Laos, there's no recourse to assets from any wider conglomerate, right? They're very self-contained in terms of the risk onto the specific projects. You can walk away and write them off a balance sheet. And so what that means in terms of the World Bank and multilateral development banks like the African Development Bank or the Asian Development Bank being the sort of main game in town in terms of financing government loans is that I was at a conference 2 weeks ago in which lead officials from the World Bank were on the record saying, we're no longer the big game in town. What we do is we provide risk guarantee, meaning that they insure these projects on behalf of larger private investors. So it's a strange time, I think, that we live in, or a new time in which, for example, in the Belt and Road Initiative, Chinese policy banks are providing balance of payment support to Pakistan. So in a way, China is acting like the World Bank and the IMF used to be for developing countries. And we've got multilateral development banks, which are now acting as insurers for the private sector in developing countries. So it's something to be aware of in terms of old actors having new roles and some new actors taking on old roles. There are some pitfalls and perils, as I said, that if you are a Lao official or an African official or a Burmese official, a Myanmar official, what I find astounding in the 7 to 8 years that I've been working on this in this sector is that there's a commonality, right? They feel quite empowered because it feels empowering to be able to commemorate something and to launch a 50-year dam. Mm-hmm. You feel like you are in the midst of history developing your country. So there's an illusion that they believe that they're developing their countries and that they're unconstrained by money. One Lao official said, we're inundated by memorandums, basically proposals. And, whichever ones we don't like, we just say next. So developing country bureaucrats feel quite empowered by the money that's flooding in. However, I want to draw attention to the kinds of projects or that fall into two particular kinds of structures and the kinds of risks that come along with that kind of financing, because money doesn't come for free. So today, if you are the OECD, the World Bank, any kind of institutional investor or Wall Street investor, you try to create these public-private partnerships, PPPs, build own transfer systems for HPPs or hydropower projects. So these are, in a sense, packages of finance between different actors that usually World Bank officials don't like developing country governments to have any more than 10 to 30% of ownership share, because then that means that they might actually exercise some kind of political right to, let's say, bring the prices of energy down. So they tend to be limited government ownership share projects that then are supplanted with other financiers. The projects need to be bankable in terms of the speak, meaning that it needs to demonstrate that the cash revenues that come from electricity generation are going to be able to pay for the cost of the project. So they tend to be, in terms of front-loading of analysis, people say that the reason the World Bank is offering these risk guarantees and insuring projects is because Western investors tend to be risk-averse. And when they're analyzing bankability, they're analyzing, most of all, whether they're going to get their money back sooner rather than later, and at the margins that they want. So it involves sometimes, in terms of governments, these projects outweigh the amount of GDP that they make in a year or even 5 years. So what is interesting for me is that I did some research in Laos in 2013, and the first traffic light in the capital was being installed in 2014. This was a year after the Lao government had been able to float a government bond on the Thai Stock Exchange. So what I'm saying is that developing countries are being tied to international capital markets in advance of, you know, basic things like traffic lights or other, you know, signs of basic development in countries. The same thing goes for Zambia. Zambia floated a sovereign bond on the London Stock Exchange to try to pay for its infrastructure projects, while a number of basic development needs in Zambia haven't yet been realized. So these kinds of projects are, given that I'm giving the talk today in the US, you'll be, you know, familiar in terms of the 2008 financial crisis that was securitization, basically, that they involved tranches of risk, different actors, bundling risk. So they're securitized projects, which means that for the Gulf country governments, they're off the balance sheet, which matters for the World Bank and the IMF because they can keep developing these projects without, in terms of an accounting trick, these projects pushing countries into debt distress. So it's an accounting measure. There's some concessional component, but usually not. But at least with these projects, there's some kind of competitive bidding. The alternative form of fast finance outside of PPP projects, and I'm not saying that Chinese firms don't engage in PPPs, but for the most part, when you look at developing country hydropower projects that are developed with Chinese hydropower, they tend to take on sovereign to sovereign, which means country to country debt between governments. They expect developing countries to take on the guarantees and the risk. And the EPCs mean that the engineering, procurement, and construction of these projects tends to come along with the bilateral deal. So that means that Chinese construction firms, Chinese turbines, Chinese labor, Chinese technology, if you go with this route, that's what you get. You might have a slope that might need a different kind of engineering design or planning that perhaps maybe an Austrian turbine or a German design turbine might be better for, but if you're tied into these arrangements, you get a bundled package, right? The difficulty with these kinds of arrangements is that they happen at commercial rates, and they have very shortened payback horizons. Once the dam is finished, you got to start paying back the loan immediately. So these might be quite expensive. Neither here nor there. Governments that kind of need to weigh the different options. But this is kind of where people get concerned about debt distress and, you know, this debt trap diplomacy and you can collateralize these loans. So what's interesting about this is in the Ghanaian example that I showed you earlier with the hippo conundrum, they were able to build this dam by collateralizing cocoa. So developing countries can now use oil, mineral assets. Ghana is rare in that it's used an agricultural commodity, but we might be seeing a lot more of developing countries using their natural resources to collateralize loans. So the risk there is that this is not off balance sheet. So the Ugandan official I spoke to 2 weeks ago was saying, we're running out of room in terms of a debt ceiling, in terms of how many Chinese projects we can take on. You know, the IMF gets really nervous. Christine Lagarde, head of the IMF, was in Beijing, you know, really concerned about a lot of these EPC contracts potentially going bust and then what, you know, that bubble bursting. And at the moment, people have heard about the Sri Lankan port that had to be abandoned or given over to China. But even in Zambia at the moment, that's, you know, another concern. So it's we haven't had enough cases in which we know what it is, what sovereign refinancing will look like. If you have to refinance with the World Bank or the IMF, we know that through, you know, two or three decades, a structural adjustment that they come in, you sign the documents, and then you start doing the austerity programs. With Chinese refinancing, we're not really sure what that means. For Zambia, that might mean that they have to abandon their assets. So you know, these projects are usually unsolicited. There's no bidding, it's opaque, it's, you know, there's not a lot of people doing research on this because it's kind of dangerous and it's hard to get access to these contracts. This is some research. It's basically, this is a list of projects from 1975 to about 2015. Not all the projects, but most of the projects in Laos that were built. And what I want to draw attention to is that the blue sections are during the 1970s through 1990s periods through which, through Cold War aid, Laos is able to build projects in which the electricity authority of Laos usually owned about 100% of the projects. So blue sections are 100% owned projects. As we get down towards the contemporary period from about 2010 onwards in this red section, these are all projects in which the Lao government never owns more than 10% of the projects anymore. And so they've shifted from having 25% through World Bank projects or these PPP projects to 10% with China. So as you saw earlier, I was talking about this shift from the World Bank to Chinese lending, right? But this continues to be a trend in which we see these 90-10 splits. So why is this happening? Well, I think this is what I started asking officials, right? If you're holding the short end of the straw, why would you do it? Well, one Lao official said it took them 10 years to build Nam Chin 2, that was the World Bank project. Who wants to deal with the World Bank? No one. Just look around. Took too long, right? They're impatient. Another guy said, I would rather build 10 dams and have half of them fail. It's not fair to keep people poor. So I think in terms of development ideology, the thing that I see across all these different contexts is that government bureaucrats are in a rush, right? They have all kinds of political constraints. They might not even be in power in 4 years' time. So they want to leave their legacies and they want to catch on to this finance and cash in on it before it goes away. Despite or regardless or irregardless of potential long-term and short-term economic risk, which they don't talk about as much. This is another Lao official. I'll keep it here. People keep criticizing, saying we are getting less benefit than the developer, but you have to think of the long term. You can't insult your buyer or they won't buy. He's talking about Thailand. This is a relationship based on trust. It takes a lot of trust established over 25 or 30 years. They'll buy 9,000 megawatts from us. It's a difficult band to break. It's like a marriage. If your partner loves you but doesn't trust you, trust is more beneficial than competition. We'll export 12,000 megawatts by 2020. They'll rely on us for 90% of their hydropower. Sometimes Goliath has to rely on David too. So a lot of developing countries are opting for these sovereign to sovereign, government to government partnerships, not just Laos and Thailand, but others with China, because they kind of think that politically they'll take the gamble, that somehow political relationships can be massaged when it comes to financial and economic relationships in the way that perhaps a strict contract with a faceless Wall Street investor might not allow you to negotiate. Whether that turns out to be the case, we don't yet know. This is a couple more perspectives from some officials I've talked to this year. It's not Chinese money that is the issue. African nations need to manage their appetite for Chinese money and monitor their debt ceilings. That's a Ugandan official. Chinese money is good. Maybe not the Exim Bank, but other Chinese banks, Chinese money has to be on the table. That's a Zambian regulatory official. He also said that his interpretation was that they were receiving a lot of bad press when it came to, this idea that Zambian dams were going to have to be forfeited. We don't need procedure after procedure after procedure, referring to the World Bank. It's about appetite, not need. It's not about appetite, it's about need. We need to develop, we need infrastructure, we need it now. We don't have 10, 20 years, we have 4. We need to develop before time is up. And this is kind of something I hear across a lot of different contexts, right? Bureaucrats are, we tend to make fun of them in the US as, slow and inefficient but bureaucrats in the developing world are really eager to get things going. Basically, what I've been saying is that, as Daniela Gabora says, there's a new sort of Wall Street consensus that is driving this private sector, this G20 push to sort of use the private sector to fill the infrastructure gap. And it comes out of, a lot of this post-2008 search for returns, right? After the financial crisis in Europe and the US, you have a lot of investors who are looking for high returns in a low interest rate world. And down projects give you a high return fairly quickly. Chin and Gallagher have called the sort of Chinese finance model a coordinated credit spaces. Again, Chinese government policy banks supporting private firms and the sort of package portfolio approach. And so what I was saying earlier about old actors having new roles and new actors having old roles, some of these old actors, I won't get into it too much, but you know, this is some more World Bank officials and other IFI officials saying, look, you know, this is in the new world, their role is to provide partial risk guarantees and insurance, right? They're supposed to trigger investment from the private sector. They're not there to lead. We're here to help with sound regulatory financing, set standards, build capacity. Development is messy. I don't see an alternative to the maximizing finance for development agenda. If you do, we can discuss it. So, you know, the Western development institutions are basically resigned to trying to act as middlemen or facilitators for institutional investors. We don't have the resources anymore. We can de-risk, we can trigger private finance, but we're not here to compete with China. That's what they say. All right, so what's really happening then on the contractual level? I'm going to kind of go over this quite quickly, and it's a bit technical, but if you have more questions, you can ask me during Q&A. So this is one of the first projects in the 1990s under the Asian Development Bank that Laos created for hydropower. I wanted to put it here because in this case, China is not the only, it's not the first time that a foreign country uses their export agency or their export bank to facilitate projects. The Norwegians were doing it in Laos in the 1990s. So the Norwegian public utility, the Statkraft, gave support to Nordic Hydropower to develop a 20% stake in a hydropower project in the 90s, right? So China just seems to be doing it on a much larger scale, but they're not the first to invent it. And so when NT2 came along, this was the famous World Bank project, which reintroduced the World Bank onto the hydropower stage. What was interesting about Nongchun 2 that I want to point out is that what it introduced in the Lao context, these legal and financial forms of engineering, it takes renovation of the legal and regulatory framework, the rewriting of laws, the introduction of investment laws, all kinds of new environmental standards, all kinds of legal renovations and institutional renovations, the creation of agencies, ministries, bureaus that might not have existed in the state to facilitate the kinds of financial contracts that are needed for advanced capital projects. So NT2, in terms of World Bank, it took 10 years and it got on the nerves of Lao officials. But in a way, it set the foundation, the institutional and legal foundation, for capitalism to work in the way that it does now. And that's one of the main takeaways. And for capitalism to work in a particular way, here you can see that it had a number of bilateral agencies involved. The Asian Development Bank was there. The U.S. Export-Import Bank was involved. You had risk guarantees from the World Bank. But you also had Thai commercial banks in the mix. So in terms of this project, it introduced a public-private partnership structure and the ability to engage or absorb that structure with the Lao government that allowed private sector actors and government agencies to bundle and get together to create these projects. And so having had that experience in Laos, this is just some examples of shareholdings. I'll get into that in a second, but if you are if you're developing a hydropower project and you're the project developer or the construction company, your goal is usually to try to sell your shares and get out of the project. That's how you make money, right? So I'll get into that in a second. But anyway, the point there about NT2 was that it allowed different actors to come together to make these projects happen. And so having had that experience, Laos then pivoted away from working with the World Bank because it would take too much time, right, in terms of the technical studies, the environmental studies, the social, you know, sort of social consultation processes with local groups. And so they turned to just Thai commercial banks, right? Well, why not just cut out the standard setter and just go with whoever's willing to finance you? So these projects, you can ask me in Q&A, but basically they take on two main timescales. The first is you have a high level of uncertainty, right? You don't know, the feasibility studies haven't been done, so you don't know if the projects, you can build it, how long it'll take to build. No permits have been drawn, so that's the greenfield part of the project. At that point, there's a certain value, right, for these different shares in the project. By the time you get to the brownfield phase, there is, you know who's going to buy the energy. Usually you know where the loans are going to come from, what kind of technology is going to be used. So there's less certainty in the brownfield phase of the project. And so the risk premium, I mean, this is very technical speak, but the risk premium in a brownfield phase is usually the previous share, plus uncertainty about how, you know, is everything going to go to plan? Are you going to have cost overruns? Might there be operational risk that you haven't foreseen? So if you're holding these shares from the beginning of the project and you offset them at the end, you make a profit. So why I'm raising this because if you get in early on a project, the whole game is to basically try to sell your shares across time and make money. Which is why I'm saying that there's an underlying driver to dam projects that are securitized across the investment cycle. There's an incentive for projects to be developed so that shareholders can make money across the investment cycle. That's my argument. Once the World Bank introduced all these institutional regulations and reforms in Laos, well, they cut them out and then Thai commercial banks from then on, in terms of all the projects, most of the projects that came afterwards in Laos, the Thais basically took over the energy market in terms of project development in Laos. There was, you know, hardly any project that took place without a Thai commercial bank involved. And so this is the first project, the Nam Nung 2 project, where it was completely financed by Thai investors. For just to sort of jump into the main point of that, in this project that then, you know, after they cut out the World Bank, here you have in the financing structure of the project, the main developer of the project lent money to a lot of the other partners so that they could purchase more shares, and then they formed a new holding company. This is a new legal entity, which then owned 51% of the project. So they became the majority shareholder of the project. So you have one company rigging the process to get the other agents, which are all, you know, former state-owned enterprises, so there's a lot of collusion here. So they're distributing funds to try to get other players to buy enough shares so that all together they can form a company to get a controlling share. So after they get the 51%, they listed it on the Thai Stock Exchange. And by listing it on the Thai Stock Exchange, they made a $125 million profit before the project even broke ground. So this is the name of the game in terms of dam development, right? I mean, when people are talking, this is not your typical Nehruvian or Nasserite post-World War II dam for agricultural development or aluminum processing. This is share shifting and high finance at its political best. So again, just another example here, it's not just the Thais. The dam that collapsed that you saw before, it also involved intra-regional investors. So here's another project where you have Thai investors pairing with Korean project developers. So we're really getting into intra-regional pairs of, you know, capitalism. I said money is not stateless, but states can also pair together when it comes to capitalism or firms. So anyway, I wanted to, this is an example basically of regional private sector actors stepping into a landscape that the World Bank was trying to, that the World Bank started and running with it. The SK Group, which was involved in the dam that collapsed, is a Korean conglomerate. They're involved in everything from semiconductors to construction and shipping. I'm, you know, sort of nearing towards time, so I'll sort of skip through a lot of this. Again, it's not just Asian investors. In Africa, you see a lot more of this attempt by Wall Street to move into African dam development. So here we have Blackstone investing initially $120 million into the project. By the time the Ugandan government has to refinance the project because they can't afford to make the payments, Blackstone sells the project to a Norwegian company and walks away with an extra $277 million profit at the expense of the Ugandan government, right? And so on and so forth here. This is what it means to bring the private sector into infrastructure to finance the infrastructure gap. So again, some more stuff about, you know, so if you're This is what industry professionals tell me when I talk to them about hydro projects. You know, banks make more money from one project than 1,000 households or small businesses. Post-2008, if you're a financial, construction, or oil firm, hydro requires upfront money, but the rate of return is at least 4% plus capital costs. Hydro is a stable investment. You always make a profit. The question is, how much profit should the government get? The developer chooses which size to buy into. The TAs want 15% in their proposals, right? This is just one industry expert. But you go to these industry events, and they all talk like this. So this is what financialization of dams means if you're an investor. Some of the outcomes that, the negative outcomes that I would say that come from these non-Nehruvian dams, these financialized dams, is that you get a misalignment of incentives and corner cutting. So, you know, it takes a lot of time to do field studies, sedimentation studies. Nobody has time for this if you're trying to do share shifting on the capital market, right? Nobody can actually afford it. And so there's excessive power and excessive debt, but no ability to access the power. So these are anti-developmental outcomes. This is not what a Nehruvian dam was supposed to do. And what it ends up doing on, in terms of the balance sheet is crowding out public spending. This is money, right? If you're guaranteeing these large loans, this is money that could also be spent on health and education. There are serious trade-offs to this. So there's huge environmental, social, and financial risks. I've gone over how this is unfolded in Laos, and I think Laos is kind of at the forefront or a warning sign scenario for other countries that are pursuing dam development, right? It's where the sort of financial and legal engineering introduced by the World Bank was pioneered. I'll leave it there. I thank you so much for coming today. And I'm open for questions or further discussion if you'd like.
I'm interested in this issue of the government ownership, their ownership share under the different financial structures. And I was intrigued that under the Chinese sovereign investment model, that the host government typically only has 10% ownership. It seems as if China, as the ultimate financier, has taken advantage of this financialization structure in which, you know, the government's ownership was limited to 10 to 30% for their own advantage, because I don't know if historically that's been the case, but sovereign to sovereign, I wouldn't have thought necessarily meant that the sovereign lender would have 90% ownership of the ultimate project, which results in Sri Lanka, you know, I think we do see in Sri Lanka and their port experience what happens when a host country defaults. The Chinese basically take over the asset.
So there is I won't name names, but there are a number of academics out there that say that Chinese investment is benevolent, right? That these projects wouldn't be possible if the Chinese didn't step in because, you know, World Bank conditions are so stringent. 90-10 has become it's become normalized. And I don't think that it's just the Chinese. The World Bank PPP structure is also, you know, no more than 10%. I had a World Bank official lamenting that Uganda wanted 30. How dare they want 30%? But I think you're right that 90-10 is alarming because this is not historically outside of, you know, the colonial period. Historically, the spirit of the post-World War Marshall Plan approach to aid, and I think this is where aid is being substituted with commercially driven finance. So aid and concessional lending is disappearing and shrinking in today's climate. And that's not, it's not some kind of natural phenomenon like, you know, droughts, right? Aid doesn't just disappear into thin air. Aid is the desire or the unwillingness to extend long-term credit. And the disappearance of grant financing and aid is a political decision. Mm-hmm. So I think you're on to something when your financiers are demanding commercial rates and 90% ownership rather than, you know, the idea and the goodwill behind post-World War. The Bretton Woods project was to create trade partners that would be equal trade partners in an equal world. And I think it says something about the aspirations of various countries around the world in terms of how they structure ownership agreements, in terms of what their aspirations might be. There is a financial argument. I mean, if I were to make a riposte from the World Bank or some Chinese commercial lenders, you know, I know what the other side will say. So they would say that, look, these countries can't afford to own more than 10%. They're too poor. And to take their financial risk off of the developing countries, they keep the ownership share low so that it's accessible for them. Whereas financing an equity stake in 30 or 40% means that the tariffs have to go up, right, to pay for that. The larger the share you want, the more you have to raise money for it. How are you going to raise money for it if you're Rwanda or Laos if what are you exporting? How are you going to pay for it? So their argument would be it has to be kept low so that it's accessible for developing countries and that it's in their interest to keep it low so that they don't overburden themselves with living beyond their means.
Hi, I'm John. I'm a first year MA in the history program here, studying China and Vietnam. A few weeks ago, there was a conference here on China and Vietnam in the Long Duran, and I met a businessman who was working in the Mekong Delta. I'm not exactly sure what his business was, but he said, it's not really that, like in Vietnam, it's not really that there's like certain factions that are pro-China and anti-China, but some are like publicly pro-China, and then some that are publicly anti-China, but privately, they're really like appreciating the money from China. Is this true in Laos and the other Southeast Asian nations?
We can only surmise what people say in public, and then, you know, you never really know what happens in their private bank accounts. But we can see, in terms of empirically tracking this, is, okay, well, there might be either legitimate or faux anti-Sino-xenophobia.
You touched on it briefly with the one of the images we saw from the Burmese case, but while I had the privilege to supervise two PhDs which were focused on the resistance of the Bak Mun, the notorious Bak Mun Dam in Ubon Lachitani, which became the main site of Thai resistance against development and against the government for more than two decades. What's happened to the anti-dam movement? It exists a bit in Myanmar. Is there any anti-dam movement in Laos? And do the people associate, because you've got all this kind of commercial intelligence with a comparative international perspective and a very sophisticated understanding of what's going on. This is incredibly hard for small groups on the ground to track and make sense of. Do people who are trying to resist dam construction in Southeast Asia have access to the kind of information that you've got?
So your question about the anti-dam movement, it was really dispiriting because after the Lao Dam collapse, one would have thought not only would the party have taken a moment to reflect and follow through with their pronouncements to review the projects, or that, you know, they would be concerned about legitimacy in terms of the wider Lao society, but there's been an increase in Laos in terms of confrontation against foreign civil society actors, diplomats have been expelled. One human rights sombat, 2012, you know, was disappeared. He was pulled from his car. Nobody knows where he is. Interpol thinks he might not be alive. So there's a lot of intimidation in Southeast Asia. This contributes and is also a reflection of the undemocratic trends in the region. I found it really refreshing and different to go to Ghana and Uganda, where people criticize on the radio, on the internet, on the streets, against officials. But even in Brazil, in the heartland of the movement for affected peoples by dams, the original terminology comes from these autonomous groups in Brazil. You know, with this mining dam collapse in February 2019, even in the heartland of transnational dam resistance, we see a dissipation. So I think that's two parts. One, there's no campaign in the world against finance, right? It's easy. There was a campaign against trade. Unequal trade is unfair. But giving us money, nobody campaigns against getting money. So I think there's something that gets lost there, and it's harder to mobilize around, don't give us money for development.
Right, this one getting at it is sort of highly abstract, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think there's that. Are people are mobilizing against dam development, but I think that there's a lot more surveillance and intimidation. There's more technologies of the state, more support for those technologies and for state oppression by outside actors than ever before. So I don't want to be pessimistic, but you can't step in the same river twice. So we're not in the 1980s anymore. with people. You know, at this conference I was just at in 2 weeks, 2 weeks ago, people there who had been working in the industry for 30 years said, wow, you know, 10, 15 years ago, we would come to these conferences and there would always be people outside, you know, it would be difficult to get through the door because there are so many protesters who hated dams. And today, you know, people's pension funds are kind of tied to these returns, and you know, there's a huge retirement gap in terms of how Western countries are going to finance the retirement gap. And so I think everyone's a lot more financially tied into financial globalization through these projects, and so it does pit, there's a lot of North-South politics in there, I think. It's, you know, financialization is a big deal, it's abstract, it's always hard to go into a room and talk about an invisible phenomenon, but it is important if we want to, you know, we care about people living in these areas, ask your fund manager, get involved in divestment campaigns, find out where your money is going. All right, so thank you very much, everyone, for coming. I really appreciate all the wonderful questions and, you know, you sharing your evening with me. I hope that it's stimulated some food for thought, and let's enjoy some pizza. Thanks.